Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 22nd, 2020, and welcome to episode 210 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and staying inside with your retro computing collection. So I'm Paul Hegstrom in Boston, and I am joined by several stay-at-home retro computing enthusiasts. So clockwise around the image that I see, we have Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hey there, Paul. I'm doing okay. I'm trying to adapt to the crazy. Just like everyone is.
Yeah. And Carrington Vanston from Toronto, all right?
The crazy will adapt to me. I'm doing fine.
That's right.
I've been socially distancing since high school, so
that's right.
Not a lot has changed in my lifestyle.
All right. And Blake Patterson from, what did you say, Northern Virginia?
Northern Virginia, yeah. That's right. And I also started social distancing rather early. But yes, home for a week and... staying sane, and
Yep, we are all old pros at this, like Jack Nutting in Stockholm.
That's right. Introverts of the world, stay home.
That's right. Anyway, yeah, so it's been pretty exciting times trying to deal with all of this. I'm sure we will have a chance to talk about that probably as our closing shots as well.
Right.
But we thought that what might be actually a kind of interesting topic to talk about is computer viruses. Seems vaguely timely.
Viruses are a topic that's in the air today.
That's right.
Viruses are in the air. What?
So there's many things that we could talk about. But, you know, like what experiences did you have in the retro computer era that we talk about with computer viruses related malware? Which ones do you remember? Were there any that caused a particularly memorable headache? Any that you wrote? Any that had interesting technology?
Anybody want to admit to a big one?
Did you write any antivirus software, or did you write any antivirus software to eliminate a virus that you wrote? Anyway, yeah, there's all kinds of things, but I think I have various things that I could say about this, but I will not start. Earl, maybe you can start being in clockwise from me.
Sure. I think my first recollection with viruses was on a PC network. We were very happy in the aerospace company that I worked at that we were early adopters of networking. Enabled us to have some competitive advantage, share files, share printers, reduce costs, that kind of thing. But unfortunately, one of the things we discovered is you can also easily transmit malware. I remember the first malware that we encountered. I don't remember what it was called, but we detected it with some software that I believe was called Virex. Do you guys remember anything called Virex?
Yep.
So Unfortunately, the virus got introduced to the network by the Novell network administrator, the supervisor on the network. So that account had basically total privileges to everybody's file shares and everything. So once he introduced it, it went crazy throughout the network. Got on individual PCs, on hard drives, yada, yada. It took us quite a while to clear it. And I remember kind of thinking, this feels like sort of a new world. I mean, I remember people doing malevolent things on computers before, usually they were just joking around. You know, they put up some sort of a funny launch screen or mess around with your autoexec.bat, you know, just prankster type stuff. But this actually cost us a lot of productivity, and it wasn't good. We did get it cleared out. We did get stomped out, but it took a while. I remember being kind of unhappy about that.
Yeah, there was a point when viruses stopped being fun.
Yeah, I mean, originally I'd heard about viruses spreading around on floppies, but they didn't go nearly as fast when you were talking about SneakerNet. But when it got on the network, man, boom.
Yeah, not cool. Carrington, do you have did you have any entrepreneurial adventures with viruses?
Nope. Oh, one time a company, I was an Apple II user, like for kind of the early years, and then became a Mac user. And so I smugly used to always say, oh, Macs don't have viruses. Yeah, I was so wrong. And so nothing much has changed. But that was I flew that flag a lot. Super fortunate. I've had no real personal experience with getting viruses, doing stuff on my own software. So yay for that, or on my own hardware. And also at work, well, my family businesses and places I've worked, never had to deal with anything like that. So just mostly through luck, to be honest. I have no idea how I've dodged all those bullets. The only time I've had to deal with it really was other people's computers. So, you know, extended family and friends was like, oh, I've got this thing all over my Windows PC. I'm like, okay. And then it becomes my problem. So I've had to deal with other people's viruses, like all tech nerds do. We have everybody's problem becomes our problem. So deal with a lot of that on Windows machines. Mac stuff, the only thing I ever really encountered personally was some HyperTalk viruses. Oh, sorry, HyperCard viruses. Like, so those used to be prevalent and really not that hard to get rid of. And so there were lots of those, in particular the NVIR A and B ones, which would say there was one of them that would say don't panic, like on your computer every once in a while, like randomly, if you had MacIntalk installed, it would say don't panic. So dealt with that one. Company that I was doing some small software development for just got a bunch of small viruses in like their HyperCard stacks. And so I had to get rid of those for them. But it was like a 10-minute thing. Like it really was – I really haven't had any issues with this. The one that I remember most of all was kind of famously there was one called Independence Day where it was a Mac virus that I kept hearing people would get, but I never encountered it personally. And I had no idea whether it was like – as big as it was, or everyone just found it hilarious because it was spelled wrong. Like Independence Day, the independence was spelled incorrectly. And it was one of these things that was a virus trying to delete things. It was trying to be a really malicious virus, but famously it was so poorly coded. It couldn't actually do anything. It was totally benign. So it could spread itself, but everything would try to do it and fail at because it was just written so badly and spelled wrong. So it's like my favorite virus, but almost unfortunately, I never personally encountered it. So that's the one I'd want to get if I got one, is that hilariously bad Independence Day one. But really don't have a personal history with them. I've been super lucky to socially distance myself computer-wise from all the viruses. Yay.
So a question for you. There were HyperCard viruses?
Yes. Oh, yeah, tons. Because HyperCard was so easy to code and you could write little scripts that would, if you open one stack, it would have little programs in it. And stacks could write code into other stacks. So you could say, hey, save this image or this bit of text into the background of this other stack. And so often what they do is try to write to the home stack because they would assume you've got a home stack, you've installed HyperCard, it's probably in the place where everyone – so you would know that stack exists. So you would try to write code that would just write itself into the program into the background of the home stack. And then if somebody opened the home stack, it would then execute. So that's technically a virus. And then it would try to write things in other stacks. And so that's kind of how they spread. But also they were super easy to get rid of for the most part, because they were just scripts.
Okay. That's very interesting. I worked with a couple of really large Macintosh networks, and we never encountered those. That's fascinating. I could see how that could be a thing.
Yeah, it was really easy to write scripts that would then write to other things. And so super simple virus writing. But Independence Day is better than that. It's awesome.
Blake, have you run across any next viruses or anything?
no next viruses. That's true. I don't have a really exciting story to tell. You'd think I might, given the different platforms I've moved through. I think I never had I went so quickly from one to the other in the early 80s that I never had time to really
other people got your viruses.
Feel a virus. Yeah.
Virus never jumped from one to the other. From Mac to
they never incompatible operating systems, it keeps itself safe. There's a benefit for you. But on the Amiga, I guess I had an Amiga 2000 for a few years. People in the user group, I was in a user group, were having some virus issues, disks getting wiped and things like that. So I that's the first time I started running a regular virus protector on the desktop, and it was something called Virus X, a little small, you know, program that just set in the menu bar. And I know, as far as I know, I mean, you know, it didn't, I didn't have any virus issues. I don't know if it protected it or not. It's like the banana in the ear that kept the gorilla out of my backyard.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's, I'm not sure. One thing it was interesting. I had real-time clock issues on that Amiga 2000, and I couldn't figure out why. It would keep time sometimes, and then like a few days later, it would lose time, and I'd set it again, and it would stay different periods of time. And I looked it up, and there was a clock chip virus for the Amiga. The Amiga has a little bit of a memory store, some kind of a EEPROM kind of thing, where you can – it stored certain just bytes of information, but there was a virus that could get in that clock the clock memory. And I thought that's what it was, but no, it turns out that the solder point was loose on the battery. So it was a soldering virus. Oops. And I guess
that's just less interesting, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. I was hoping it was the clock virus, but
we were all hoping.
Yeah, but maybe I can see if I can, you know, set that up. I'll see if I can
get it now.
Acquire that.
It's pretty hilarious if you give yourself a virus on air during the show. Let me show you that worked. Oh darn.
Yeah, that's scary. But the I remember in the college, we had a Sun Lab. There was an HP lab and a Sun Lab, and primarily the I worked in the Sun Labs doing projects and things like that. And there was some kind of a virus that came through that would hit a certain Spark processor, and it would put it into a certain loop that would cause it to physically melt. And so there were several servers where the CPU cores were physically destroyed. Wow. By a malicious, you know, I don't know if it was technically a virus. It was a malicious program that was masquerading as something else. I guess it was a virus, but I think there were three machines at great expense that were destroyed.
Wow. That is a hardcore payload.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't really believe that was possible, but when I looked into it, yeah, there was some sort of.
Sure. You could like disable a fan and then just run a thing like crazy, like especially check like that it's sitting idle and it's 2 a.m. or whatever, and just like crank it and let's heat this thing till exhaust.
Well, if you could turn that fan off, but yeah, I think it did some kind of a loop where it just wouldn't, the safeguard mechanism, you know, for voltage level just didn't foresee that. And, they corrected it obviously in the next chip. But the last thing I'll say is that the most virus headache I've ever had is helping my mother-in-law to not purchase several times a year the McAfee virus package.
Oh my gosh,
her
yes.
System on Windows 10. Like, we set her up and it comes up. Would you like to order? You're going to run out in 11 months of this subscription. And I think she purchased four times she purchased the suite, the $60 suite of
Mac. That is their entire business plan.
Thing I ever did, the biggest virus like solution I ever did was to uninstall McAfee on her Windows 10 PC and then just never look back. And so she's never mentioned viruses. She's never had one. So yeah, that was my most painful virus experience. Yeah.
A lot of antivirus software is
the McAfee. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So
anyway, I've had the same problem at work. We'll have staff every once in a while say, oh, things are running slow, so I installed that Mac cleaner thing. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm taking away all your privileges. You don't get a password anymore. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. You don't get a keyboard anymore. What you can do with the mouse, that's what you can handle. Crazy how many times I've had to uninstall that stupid thing from people's computers.
There's very few. There's a few out there. I think you can, you know, install them. They'll do something. Get them out of there. You know, okay, now I'm checked. I checked for viruses. But, yeah, the things like McAfee, I mean, they're worse, I think, than a virus itself. So as far as I'm concerned.
Strong agree.
The cure is worse than the disease.
Anyway, so that's it for me.
So what about you, Jack? Have you had any virus attacks or
not much. Defenses? And surely not in the retro days. I do remember on the Amiga, I think I also ran that Virus X program because I was dealing with, I had so many pirated games and such that I had. And I had a hard drive. That is, you know, there was a concern that if I, you know, got some floppy from a friend or a friend and it had some virus on it that would actually, you know, impact something on my hard drive, I didn't want that. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, every computer that I had was such a, you know, a minority platform, the Atari 8-bits, the Atari ST, and like no one.
Yeah, who's going to bother writing anything for
exactly.
That?
Exactly. And then after that, mm-hmm. Then I went on to, you know, be working in NextStep for a number of years. And that's also such a small platform that nobody's writing viruses for that. And then I went from NextStep to Mac OS X, which again, you know, in 2000, especially when it was new, like barely anybody even wanted to use it, let alone like who's going to write a virus for that?
It's the world's slowest virus.
So, I don't think today there's many viruses for Mac OS.
I don't think so either. I think it's still, you know, the
maybe a few
people want to get the most bang for their buck when it comes to like if they're going to make a virus, you want to make it for the majority platform, which on the desktop is still Windows. So like my only virus experiences that were troublesome at all were really in work life, but kind of late on, like say 1999, 2000. I remember working at a place where, you know, we had an internet connection. Didn't have much of a firewall or anything because it was still early days and we were, you know, I guess we were a little bit naive. I think most companies and universities were pretty naive early on. And at some point something happened and there was some kind of Windows virus that would reach out across networks and try and infect things through something. Like I remember there was one day that everybody who was running Windows suddenly all had this virus at the office. And these were all the These weren't the developers. These were all like sort of the finance people and the people doing the accounting and the books and stuff.
Worst.
They were the worst, and they were freaking out, and we had to fix it.
I know the modern day, like the guys that are running, and I, of course, am one. I have one of these systems down by my left leg. But one of the modern PowerPC Amiga OS 4.0 people that are still pushing hard with modern Amigas, their biggest hope and dream is that someone will write a new virus targeting their platform. That's everyone is. Has there ever been? Has anyone
It'll validate
heard,
you?
Is, a right
anyone
of
fallen? Anyone
you
got
noticed us.
Got bitten? So yeah, one day, hopefully, you know, there'll be a new Amiga virus.
I can't say. I think the thing that protected me from having to deal with a ton of viruses, to be honest, is my age, because as a young kid, I pirated. Everything. I mean, just every game I used was just I don't know how I got it, but it was in. Yeah. I'm old enough that was before hard drives, so it was 5 1/4 inch floppy disks with tons of games on them that I got from any old source anywhere, and BBSs and just like crazy stuff that I didn't even think about it, and it just wasn't an issue. And then by the time I moved to computers with hard drives, I was old enough that I could afford to buy software now. I'm aged out of wanting to have 10,000 games that I wouldn't play that I just put on everything. So honestly, that's what protected me. It was by no means intelligence or ability. It was strictly because I'm as old as the hills. And so I just avoided it.
Yeah, once you turn off the power switch, you know, you finish playing a game on your Apple II Plus, you turn the power off and, you know, now we're move on to the next thing.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's really the reason I ducked the bullet.
Yeah.
Because if I had that same methodology, but I was born 10 years older. And so instead of doing that all through the, you know, the late 70s and early 80s, I did it through the late 80s and into the 90s. I would have got every virus everywhere. So I shouldn't really be smug about it.
Yeah, it does sort of seem like the viruses, you know, I said that sort of jokingly before, but I mean, the viruses used to be kind of fun. You know, it was sort of it was like a little technology demo. Like, it's an interesting idea. Like, how can you get this to replicate itself?
Right.
You know, and make a little funny message somewhere. And, you know.
Yeah, there was that Mac Mag magazine or Mac Mag virus. Do you guys remember that one? Which was like written by one person, but the responsibility was like I think in the UK, Mac Mag, they wrote a virus for their staff intentional that would pop up at a certain date and say, you know, the name of the president, like Richard something, Richard Brandon says, Merry Christmas. And we're spreading the message of peace to everybody from all the staff of Mac Mag. I'm like, you're writing a virus to promote your magazine. It was like the weirdest thing. And it was supposed to delete itself on a certain day. But again, I think did damage because it had coding errors. Mm. I mean, I swear viruses do more problems because of errors in their code than intentional things.
Yeah. Possibly.
Yeah. And I mean, it's actually sort of interesting to creatively think about like where you can hide them, you know, how you can make them persist. So like those Mac, they were like CDEV viruses or something that would,
I remember those.
That, you know, like when you booted up a system software disk, it would quickly like, you know, run all your control panels or whatever and in a completely unprotected way. Yeah, I remember those were moving around in the Mac labs at college. But yeah, I think it's true that in the floppy based world, it is a little bit harder to have them spread. You know, so I know a lot of them would patch DOS so that like if you're using a sort of normal unprotected DOS, they would and then you went to go catalog a different disk, it would quickly like write itself into the boot sectors of that disk.
Oh, cool. That's creative.
Yeah. I experimented with this a little bit. I never released any,
but sure,
I did like, you know, write through some little things to like a little thing in the boot sector of an Apple II disk that would count down, you know, a certain number of times that you could boot it before it would then, you know, just format the disk or something. but you know, it is there's a fun sort of engineering challenge to try to, like, you know, squish this into a couple of little bytes, you know, here and there around the memory. But yeah, I think it's possible that viruses in fact are one of the things that keep me from, like, even maybe beyond, you know, ethics and morality, keep me from pirating anything. Because, you know, everything has an actual malicious intent. It's trying to make your computer into a botnet.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, I say I never had an experience with viruses, really, but I could be just straight, like, they could be all over. I could be totally the center of a botnet and just not realize it. I don't think so. I think I'm aware of my network traffic, but who knows?
Yeah.
One thing I guess I'll mention, I thinking about it now is listening to you guys talk, when I was, I guess, mainly at this one job I had in like the late 90s, I was a developer, my first dev job actually. But anyway, that was at like 98, 99, 2000. That was when you remember the, I guess there's still a thing, but the Microsoft Word macro viruses,
yeah,
you know,
yep,
where it would basically, it wasn't like a straight up, you know, assembly coded virus of extreme cleverness. It was more someone is going to, you know, go in and look at all your email addresses and send out, you know, garbage emails.
Right.
Those were hitting the office. Mm-hmm. And I didn't care so much because it really wasn't my personal problem. But but yeah, we would see those come and they'd warn, you know, don't open the email. But yeah. Now, I guess the modern version of that is phishing emails today, which are more, yeah, like malicious, not in, right, the same way, but heavily warned about that in the current workplace. And you see those emails.
So, yeah.
And I still struggle to keep my family, I keep my parents from believing everything that comes, and they try every metaphor ever. And it's like, how could you possibly think that was okay to click? How many times have I said you don't click on links in your, what do I have to do to protect you?
Yeah.
It's very hard to protect my family from my family.
Yeah. You know, the thing that is just, this makes me want to, I don't know, whatever, tear my hair out or whatever, is that then you will get an actual bank sending you an actual email that says, click on this link to, you know,
what are you
do
doing?
This thing.
I don't even want to bank with you if you're that.
Yeah. Because, yeah. I mean, I know it's not a phishing email. I can see evidence of it, you know, when I log in. But still. Yeah, it's irresponsible.
Yeah. And it's not even an age thing, because my nephew, who's way younger than me, also probably the worst person in my family when it comes to tech. I'm like, oh my God, anyone's going to get virus. It's that kid. It's like, ah. Like, so I originally thought it would be like, well, eventually everyone who doesn't understand this stuff will simply age out and die and the world will be safe from viruses. Nope. Young people are just as stupid as old people. We're all dumb. Or maybe it's just my bloodline. I don't know. There's a good chance it's the latter.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think if there's any other, I probably did tell this before. There's one thing that I think is kind of like virus related, which I was very pleased about. I'm sure I told it before because of this, but it was sort of like, it was kind of like a computer lab prank that I perpetrated in junior high. But we had all the Apple II, it was an Apple IIe lab. So there was probably 25, 30 machines or something in there. They were all connected to a network drive. So it was like I think it might've been 20 entire megabytes of Corpus drive that they were connected to.
Oh my gosh, I've experienced with exactly that. Corpus drive shared over a network. Like, oh my gosh, wow.
Yeah, that's cool.
Like, I can relate hard to that.
And so being, there were a couple of us, there were I think three of us that were sort of like the computer nerds, and we each got our own volume on this. So it was divided into a whole bunch of volumes, and like, you know, everybody could access everything, but you know, I was supposed to put my stuff on my volume. So, But so the thing I did was basically like there was a kind of like a login screen that you would type in some code. It would run something on the Corvus drive. So I think there were various like, you know, educational games and things. But what I did was made a little mock-up of the login screen that would pull my volume to see if like a file existed on it or something. And then like when the file existed, then they would all start beeping. So that I could just make the whole, actually it wasn't even beeping. It was like a super high pitched noise. It was like the highest pitched noise an Apple II could make. So
nice.
It was, you know, it was kind of fun to like be able to go and walk up to one of the computers, type in like the magic thing on the login screen, and have them all start like making noise.
Oh, the sense of power.
But not really a virus. I did. Oh, yeah. So the Apple II thing, I did write up some text files about like my writing of these, you know, like the you know, boot counter and stuff like that. And I once saw an eBay auction with somebody who had a disc in like in their miscellaneous discs that had it on it.
Oh,
like,
nice.
Like, That's interesting. I don't even know if I have a copy of that.
That's wow. Cool.
But it was
when you say a boot counter, it sounds very Canadian.
That's right.
So I was like, wow. Talk about relating to that one.
All right. Anyway, all right. It's possible that we've exhausted the computer virus topic for now, but it's possible that we'll still be talking about it.
It'll be back as viruses do.
Months and months.
I think we have flattened the curve.
Okay. So let's see. I have a couple of listener feedback things. The first one is, now they're both just news things, but anyway. So Brian on Facebook wrote something which I thought was, pointed something out I thought was interesting. It's the PLA 20V8, which is a cheap PLA replacement for a Commodore 64. He says he's made a few of them, and they've worked on every C64 he's tried. And there's a link to how you put this together, and there's a video made by the person who put it together sort of talking about it. Earl, what does the PLA do? It's some sort of video-related thing, I believe. Do you know what this is that they're replacing?
I don't think it's a video-related thing. I don't know exactly all the functions that it does in the Commodore 64, but there's actually I don't know if the video that you're talking about is the one that I saw recently from Adrian's Digital Basement.
That's it, yeah.
That's a perfect video to watch if you want to know not only what the PLA does, but how you can build yourself one of these really cheap replacements. And I mean, they're very inexpensive compared to some of the alternatives. There are alternatives out there because the PLA is one of the chips in the C64 that fails frequently. It's a very common failure mode. And so people have been looking for a modern way to replace this. And not only is this new modern replacement that uses GAL chips cheap, but it's also extremely compatible. They threw some different tests at it, and you can see that in this video, that they throw a couple cartridges at it that are known to really have edge case issues with the PLA, and it works just perfectly. So I'm very impressed with this.
Yeah, it seemed like it. And I think if you make enough of them, and enough of them is like 10 or something like that, then they wind up being something like $3 each. I mean, like it's really like, it's unreal.
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can trade Adrian something here in town because he's here in Portland with me.
Oh, okay.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. What the heck's a PLA? I know I'm a software guy, but I don't even know this term.
Does it stand for Programmable Logic Array? I think it does.
I will believe you if you say it does.
I think that's what it stands
for. What is, so it's a chip?
It's a chip, right. It's a piece of hardware. And it was...
Like, is it a C64 only thing or does every computer... Like, I don't know why I don't know this term.
I don't know to what extent they're used today, but one of their big deals was that they were programmable. Like...
Because I know it is like a... Like, in a chip, a PLA is, you know, pull... Accumulator from stack.
Right.
Like,
it's that's what I think. No.
I'm like, what the heck is PLA as a chip?
Yep.
I don't know this. So it's a chip in the C64 that is prone to fail, is what you're telling me. And so then this is a cheap replacement.
That's right. All those things are true. And PLAs in general, I'm not sure what their overall success was. They were interesting because they were programmable. But the ones that they put in the Commodore, I think they were just trying to solve some technical issues by using one of these chips. And I don't think the one that's in the Commodore is programmable. I think it's, you know, it already pre-programmed. You can't reprogram it, for instance, if you have one. But the replacements that people are making can be reprogrammed. They can be reflashed. And I think you actually see that happening in this video that we're talking about. So think like, you know, a CPLD or an FPGA or something like that, but I think a previous version of it.
Yeah, I'm thinking it seems FPGA-like, and I'm now reading about it on Wikipedia, and I remember having to do these kind of schematics, input and output things using ANDs and ORs so people would learn gate logic. Mm-hmm. I just don't remember the term PLA or being a chip. Though, you know, it, my degree's a long time ago. I forgot most of it.
So is it, so how does that differ from like a PROM? I mean, isn't that the same thing? Like it's once programmable read-only memory, or is this doing something more than just being memory?
It must be doing something other than being a ROM. I'm just theorizing here, but
yeah. Or Commodore people just want their own word.
Well, does the did you find out that it really does stand for programmable logic array?
Yep, programmable logic
array. Because if that's the case, that implies to me that more than just a ROM, it actually has the capability to do some programmable things in it. Like a ROM, you can say, hey, at this address, you read this value. But a programmable logic array could actually run little mini programs inside it.
Yeah.
So like probably given a set of inputs, it will produce an output.
Like yeah, it just needs to be a whole bunch of gates that you can program.
Yeah. Yeah. So somebody out there in Listenerville is probably screaming at their audio player
that
right
now.
That
is the experience of listening to our podcast, is mostly just waiting for your turn to scream.
It's an hour and a half to 2 hours of just screaming. But it's cathartic, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. That's our gift to you, the more knowledgeable listener.
Yeah. But it does seem like it's a Commodore 64, a specific piece that commonly fails, and this is a cheaper replacement than the many others that have been made before.
Cool. That's right.
So it's a cheap piece of a Commodore 64 that fails, but we're going to focus on this one part of it versus just, you know, the whole thing.
Mr. Facetious Man, there are other cheap pieces of the Commodore that fail, and they've been looking for replacements for those too. You should check it out because it's actually kind of interesting. I mean, pretty soon I think you've got a Frankenstein where you've got a bunch of chips in there that aren't the originals, but the thing still runs. So we've talked about this before on the RCR, where at what point does it stop being a Commodore or an Atari or an Apple or something like that and start being like a modern computer that just acts like an old computer?
Right. Okay, so that was feedback. There's another piece of feedback that I thought was interesting too. This one, Jason posted this on Facebook about a project that he'd planned to present, I think, at VCF East, which didn't happen. But I think it's just now, just as I'm speaking, not happening. But at any rate, it's basically a little program written in BASIC that lets you interact with the Atari 6502 processor in kind of a visual way. And so he's put this on atariprojects.org, and so you can take a look at it. But I think it's kind of cool. Basically, you pick an instruction and it runs a little bit of code that uses that instruction. And, you know, it's supposed to kind of like, I think, A, be kind of like a basic, an exercise in BASIC, but also, you know, it can get you used to at least these opcodes that it displays here. So it reminds me a little bit of something called the Visual 6502 that I've seen on Apple computers, at least. I think there's a similar one on PCs as well. The visual, whatever that is, whatever's in PCs. But it's neat. That's a neat project, and it's a good way to sort of deal with the fact that VCF East isn't happening to present to that.
Right. It looks pretty neat. Yeah, it shows like what's in the X, Y, and A registers, and what's in the current RAM that's being dealt with somehow. It's neat. I'll have to give this thing a try.
Yes, there's a copy and pastable program that you can paste into your computer. You need a fancier BASIC though. You need Altera or BASIC XL.
Yeah, you need BASIC XL.
Yeah. So.
Cool.
Okay, and then if there's more feedback, I'll talk about it next time.
Has everybody given us their first jobs? Anybody online who hasn't had a chance to discuss that yet before we move on?
Oh, that's a good point.
Items of interest and such.
I think we have all done this. We got to get Michael here.
Yeah. Give me the hot seat.
But okay, so now we can move to our items of interest and news. And
very distinct section.
Yep. Carrington, you have the
all
first
the
one.
Parts of this show are very distinct.
It's true.
Very distinct. 8-Bit Weapon, a very fun independent music band that does a lot of kind of music you would think from a band called 8-Bit Weapon, like computer-oriented stuff. Back in October, they released a dual album called Disassembly Language that was Commodore 64 music, so generated on Commodore 64 for relaxation. The idea was you can chill out to it. So it's chill music created on a Commodore 64, and that came out in October. Well, since the world is going insane and it's the end of civilization and all of that, they're like, you know what? It's time for everybody to relax. And so what they've done is now that music is free. So if you've not checked out 8-Bit Weapon, and you should because they're actually fun band and make good music, you can get both of those albums now for free on Bandcamp if you head over to the 8-Bit Weapon site, which is just 8bitweapon.com, and we'll have a link in the show notes. So both Disassembly Language Volumes 1 and 2 are now released completely for free. So you can check them out and enjoy their music guilt-free and probably virus-free. Who knows? but download it and take your chances. Anyway, cool. They put up a post recently called Relax, It's On Us, free C64 ambient music. And so both albums are now available for free. Hooray for them. Good band. I like them.
Yep, they're good.
They're fun. Nice.
Yeah, I have a few different 8-bit Weapon app, albums, and what I think the one I listen to most is an interesting one not too long ago released called Class Apples.
Class Apples, yeah. That's what I was going to say. That's my favorite of theirs as well.
Yeah, they use Apple IIs, not with sound cards, but the Apple II itself in a very unusual way. I know Charles Mangan assisted in the, on the technical side to getting the Apple IIs to work. It's kind of fascinating. But they're classical tunes, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, super fun. I like them. They're a good creative band that does neat things. Hooray for supporting independent music. And so you can support them by taking their stuff for free now. But then maybe you'll like it and buy another album. Yep. So we'll see. So anyway, that is my bit of news to contribute.
That is really cool of them.
Cool.
Yeah. Lots of people are doing that. Lots of games and stuff are available for free right now on itch.io or whatever and Steam. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many things that are currently 100% off.
Yeah, that is right. That is nice.
I worry
about
so
people.
Many games in my backlog of games to play. We could be quarantined for 5 years, and I would still be like, I never got through everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of other discounts. Like I saw, and again, don't quote me on the nature or
I'm tweeting
whatever
right
the
now.
Situation with this is, but I heard that for several months you can get access to I think Adobe Creative Cloud for free for people that might need to take a different step angle towards work.
And the key to remember with those is I use that stuff for work all the time, but it's all very proprietary file format. So you want to make sure you export everything as PDF or whatever, because once it ends, you're like, hey, I got all these things in Illustrator format or InDesign. It's like, bad, sucker, keep paying.
Yep. Lots of sales though. Lots of sales. Yep. Yeah. Which is nice to see.
I'm really interested to listen to that 8-Bit Weapon album that you're talking about, because a lot of the music that you'll find on the Commodore 64 is really hyper. I mean, it's definitely not something to relax to. I guess that's just, part of the culture, the demo culture. Very upbeat, very busy. Mm. So listening to something that's a little bit more chill coming out of the SID chip is going to be interesting. Mm.
Yeah, I remember when they announced it, I think we talked about it back in October when it first came out, they called it mind debugging tones, so your neural network could chill out. They're like I said, a good band, worth supporting.
I think volume one of that came out a couple of years ago. I remember,
oh, really? Okay. I remember, it was like last October.
But maybe volume two came out very recently.
I remember talking about it.
Right. But I remember listening to volume one because it's on Spotify too. I remember listening to it a bit a couple of years ago. And it is very, it's not at all like you think of like chiptune music,
which is normally pretty aggressive.
Right.
Like, go, go, go.
Nope.
Drink your jolt. Play your games.
Pretty soothing. It's nice.
Cool.
Everything's soothing if you slow it down enough.
That's what I say.
Yeah, I know a lot of people will listen to podcasts and things at double speed, just in order to be able to consume more. And
I say challenge accepted. Listen to my podcast at double speed. Go, go, go.
But it's and actually, I do find I do this myself a fair amount, and I do find that the brain adjusts pretty quickly. But what I was going to say is that try listening at half speed. Everybody's going to sound entirely drunk.
That's right. Everybody sounds drunk. It's so hilarious.
I'm not drunk. I'm just at half speed.
That's right.
We're talking about officer.
All right. The Apple news continues with Jack.
Yeah, Apple news from me. So
mine was C64 news, surprisingly.
There's a cool story on Ars Technica. They have their series called War Stories. They have a little interview with Jordan Mechner about how he created Prince of Persia. And it was pretty neat. Like, I never knew any of these details. Maybe some of you did. But there's a 20-something minute video on YouTube where he's talking through things and demonstrating how he created the characters and the struggles he had with fitting things into the RAM of the Apple II, this sort of thing. Very interesting and very entertaining. And there's an article on Ars Technica about this, and it's pretty cool. He actually saved his journals from when he was working on this, so that's why he has like a pretty clear memory and can refer back to those for the details. And so he used a kind of rotoscoping for the character animations. So he had the prince is Jordan Mechner's brother, who was videotaped him running along a sidewalk and jumping over things and stuff. He took the videotape and he goes through it frame by frame, freeze frame it, take a photo of it, and then get the photos all developed. And then from the photos, he would do an overlay of just like black and white of character and background. And then he used some tool that let him take a frame from a video camera, a solid frame, and import it as a bitmap into the Apple II. So it's kind of like a multiple step thing to get these animations of his brother into the game. But it worked, obviously. And that was the basis for. And he also mentioned that a similar technique was used for when he made Karateka earlier. And that was that he had his karate teacher stand and do poses and do kicks and punches and stuff and recorded all that. So anyway, pretty neat. Well worth checking out.
There's in the Ars Technica article, it's talking about something that I hadn't heard before about busting through the memory, like the memory limitations, trying to do something like Prince of Persia, which is just a masterpiece, and trying to get that to like fit on an Apple II. And originally the game was going to be designed that there were no sword fights, none of that. It was just going to be like basically a maze you have to jump through.
Right.
So it'll be the platforms and the chompers, those amazing chompers. And that was it. And you just had to make your way through this to rescue the princess.
Right.
Alas, there's the theme. And there was this sudden idea, I guess, from a person that was in the same office he's working with. And they came up with the idea of bit shifting. So then you can take there's the one character they had, like our prince. And by just doing bit shifting, now you have another character. So you just reverse it, bit shifting. Okay, now, because there wasn't enough room, there weren't graphics left to be able to have an enemy.
Right.
But instead, now you can have an enemy, because by just bit shifting it, like that gives you an enough different looking character. Use all the same animations,
yep.
Just reversing it, and bingo, now you have people you can fight. And that idea just suddenly opened it up to be a game that is now not as he says, a completely solitary experience. Instead, you're going to have to go fight a bunch of bad guys,
right.
Which is a big part of the game, that sword fighting. So pretty amazing.
Yeah, he said that also that like opening up that actually set the tone for the game, because it became more story driven, because suddenly there is a bad guy that is bugging you and stuff. And someone in the office is like, oh, make the bad guy appear when he jumps through a mirror. And that then that's when Shadow Man appears. And so like that kind of set. It went from a game that was just kind of like a technical demo of I can run around and jump and climb and fall and all these things, to being a thing where suddenly I have a new element that influenced how the game evolved.
Yeah. That was one of those all-time great moments. There's certain games I've played that like you just have a moment in a game that is incredible. And that's Prince of Persia. I mean, the first sword fights and stuff, like they're so good at jumping the first time you fall down the pit and all that. But when you jump through that mirror and your other self just comes out the other side of it, it's like, oh, what's happening here? that was great. Oh, there's some just seminal moments in that game.
Yep.
Kind of a side note, that game was in another news recently. I listened to a podcast called Command Line Heroes from Red Hat. It's about programming and anyway, they've been doing a lot of exploration of computer history lately, and their latest episodes were on floppy disks. Where did the floppy disk come from? How did it get popularized? And that part of the episode, they were talking about when they were rescuing the source code for Prince of Persia. And it's interesting. They had Jason Scott on there. Tony Diaz was on there because they were involved in that restoration effort. I thought it was fascinating. Anyway, it's a fun listen.
Yeah, that seems – I remember that. I'm sure we talked about that back when it happened, but
– I think so.
It's a really sort of like dramatic story, finding these old floppies in the in the, you know, the parents' house or whatever.
And then rescuing them. And I guess Tony had dragged over a bunch of equipment, you know, specialized equipment for imaging them at like the magnetic flux level first, and then going through and, you know, stuff we talk about all the time, but it I don't typically hear about that kind of thing on mainstream consumer podcasts. So it was fun hearing that on there.
But
yeah, my guess is that Tony brought a bunch of stuff. I sort of vaguely remember that, like, Tony brought a bunch of contemporaneous hardware that in the end it wasn't really helpful.
Oh, because, that's okay.
Because just used a modern flux
just
thing.
Bring it all.
But yeah. Okay. Let's see. So I have the next thing is, oh, actually, before I do that, was Prince of Persia, that was on multiple platforms, right? Or was it, did it get ported to other things?
It has recently been ported.
Yeah, I got ported a whole bunch of things, but it was Apple II first. And he also mentioned in the video how he was kind of bummed that by the time it was released for the Apple II in 1989, like that was a platform that was so much on the wane that he was like, it was concerning him while he was building the game too. He's like, am I building a game for a platform that's going to die? And so he says that on the Apple II, it was a commercial flop, but it was all the ports that were done right after that made it work. And all those ports that were to newer platforms didn't have any of the technical challenges he had in the Apple II. Mm-hmm, right. But it was interesting that the constraints of the Apple II were what sort of formed the game into what it became. Whereas if he'd been making this for the Amiga from the outset, he would have had, you know, all kinds of enemies to fight. He probably would have thrown in too much. It wouldn't have been the simple pared down experience that he made.
Interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause I definitely played it on the Apple II and I think early Macintosh as well.
Yeah, there was a very, very well done Mac version. It was very clean on the color Macs, and there was like Sega Genesis, you know, those kind of things that appeared on consoles. And I think it was reported here like a year ago that it was ported to the Commodore 64. I think within the last 9 months or something.
There have been people working on Commodore 64 and Atari 8-bit versions.
Atari 8-bit, yeah. I think I've seen some test screens of the 8-bit very recently of the Atari 8-bit.
I don't know if any of these are complete or nearly complete, but there's work being done. So
It's pretty funny that he worried putting it out for the Apple II in the late 80s or 1990 or whatever was for a waning platform. But here we are in 2010. Let's release it for 2020. Let's release it for the Commodore 64. Right. It's on the rise. Okay.
All right. So let's see. So the thing I have, it's long, and so I haven't actually read through all of it, but it's really super interesting, and I think I'm looking forward to reading all of it, and I will present it to you. But on Ken Sheriff's blog, he has written up – he was basically asking the question of why the sort of standard terminal size is 80 by 24 or 80 by 25.
Oh, that's a great question, actually. I've wondered that myself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why is it?
Paul doesn't know, he hasn't read it yet.
Right, exactly. Well, no, so, I mean, it's basically, there are a bunch of people who have had sort of theories about this that have to do with, like, what IBM, you know, sort of things about, like, how memory is organized or what IBM put out, or, you know, a lot of it's kind of centered around, I think, certain technical capabilities, like what, you know, what is a natural size. And so he actually kind of goes through kind of a long sort of list of different terminals, like, you know, the terminal was 80 by 20, the VT100 was 80 by 24, not 80 by 25. There's a lot of fuzziness about 24 versus 25, you know. I think some of it had to do with the teletype and how wide the teletypes were. There was some idea that maybe the IBM 3270, being like a very widely adopted terminal, had something to do with this. And then he just wanders. And that's the thing that I think is, like, the most delightful about this is he talks about the 3270 terminal, but then talks about an earlier one, the IBM 2260. And then he starts talking about memory delay lines and, you know, various things about the video display and the 80 by 25 that went into the IBM PC. And it's really long, full of interesting stuff. Not all of it immediately. It's not immediately evident how to connect everything in this article to the question of why are things 80 by 24, but
That's funny, because I always assumed it had something to do with manuscript format. Like when you're – like the old-fashioned way of typing of things was 60 characters on a line, because in a typewriter font, by 25. So manuscript format is 25 lines per page. And I always figured it was 25 because that was a thing. But I went like, why is it 80 instead of 60? It just – it always seemed confusing to me. I thought it was a coincidence that that you know, for decades before computers, manuscript format was 25 lines a page.
So weren't computer cards 80 columns? I wonder if that has anything to do with
it. Yeah, we should read the article.
Yeah, so a standard 80-column IBM punch card was introduced in 1928. I mean, I think basically his conclusion winds up being that there's no technical explanation for this. It really just has to do with adoption, basically, and IBM in their sort of central role in all of this.
So, I think that there's a link. It's a lengthy piece indeed, but I remember because I encountered this article, and I remember there was some indication. I think they were talking about the Apple II, but it was, or maybe it was a terminal that was reflecting the Apple II, but there was just enough memory because of something that they had to do that they got that extra line. So some of the terminals were 24, and then this one was 25 because it didn't quite, you know, it had all this free memory, which of course all this being less than 1K, but and that enabled another line. So it was just interesting little anecdotes like that. If you know, read through. I didn't read the whole thing myself, but it was,
I do. I'll read it though.
His blog is amazing. Yeah. Like, so yeah, everything on there is worth reading.
Yeah. Well, and I think the question is really interesting and like sort of talking through it, you know, is pretty interesting, but what I really love about this is really just the trail he wanders down. I mean, like, you know, he keeps touching things that are, you know, coming across things that are sort of interesting and related, and then just talks about that for a while, like how the displays were all done by pushing bits on this delay line and stuff. So anyway, we will all read it together soon.
Yes.
We'll read it live to you now.
Yeah. Okay, Earl, I guess you have the next thing. It looks kind of short.
Yeah, just real brief. It looks like the Commodore Los Angeles Super Show, they call it the class, was scheduled to be in late April, but one of the latest casualties of the worldwide challenge that we're facing, so they're postponing it. And we'll have a link in the show notes to the, I looked at it on Google Groups. It's out on the news groups, comp.sys.cbm is where it's at. But just a notification that they're pushing off that show, and kind of a side thought that I wouldn't be surprised if a number of the upcoming shows suffer the same fate, depending on how things go.
Mm. Yep. Yeah. Okay. So do I want to talk about this? I suppose I do. I think this is interesting. So I suppose we all know about, in some form or another, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? So there was the game. It appeared on many different platforms. There were many different sort of types. So there's where in the USA, where in the world. There were a number of these. I'm trying to remember actually what the other ones were, but yeah, like, and they were basically sort of like geography learning games, you know, so you're supposed to learn facts about places and know where they are and that kind of thing. It's a sort of a kid's game. And there was even a TV show, but it turned out that during a kind of like a period of time when North Dakota was, I don't know, doing some sort of education push toward like teaching the heritage of the state in the schools, somebody had the idea of basically commissioning a Where in North Dakota is Carmen Sandiego game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's basically this same framework, but in the context of North Dakota history and things like that. And they made it, and it's impossible to find. Like, I've been kind of like looking for this for quite a while because I heard that it existed. But so there's this write-up on the Video Game History Foundation's site, gamehistory.org, about this. It's written by David Kroduk, and it's actually super interesting. I mean, you know, so it sort of details going to North Dakota, talking to the people, you know, who were sort of involved in kind of pulling this thing together. And so it's basically, this was a Broderbund game, right? And so they worked with Broderbund to do this. But so not just finding a copy of it, but actually what they, you know, what they did was go out and actually talk to the people who made it and, you know, look at some of the materials. I believe that it actually did go out. Like, I believe the teachers actually had it, but it's amazing how it just plain does not surface. So I think the stuff that the Video Game History Foundation has is actually like the development materials. I don't know if anybody has an actual end product version. But anyway, it's actually quite a long article, and it's pretty detailed about, you know, just the whole process and what led to it and, you know, what was involved. And I think it's pretty interesting. And so read that if you are interested. It is available on the Apple II. Like 4AM has tweeted, I think, at least a WAS version of it, you know, like, so it's you can play it if you want to. Anyway, anyone have played it? Had anyone heard of it before this?
Nope. No. Well, not until recently. So many 4AM tweets and things have been about North Dakota for some weird reason. Right. And all the amazing Apple II software that seems to...
Why is North Dakota trending?
Yeah, exactly. It's very weirdly trended for the Apple II community. But other than that, no, I had never heard of it. Carmen San Diego, obviously. Where in time? Where in America's past? Where in Europe? Where in blah, blah, blah. Where? Mm-hmm. Though I don't think I've ever actually played any of those games.
I have not either. I've played for maybe 6 minutes once. So
you're like, that's enough.
But was it a good 6 minutes?
Yeah, well, it didn't make it to seven, so although I did buy a couple of little handheld ones, so I could conceivably
right
still play them, but I played that for maybe a minute. Okay, so the next piece in the show notes is the upcoming show roundup.
Actually, hang on a second, Blake added something.
Oh, okay. Yeah, one last thing then before we move on to that. So, Blake, what's your thing?
Okay, it's a quick one, really. It's actually a lengthy article, middling, but it's an article entitled ASCII Art Plus Permadeath, The History of Roguelike Games. And roguelike games, as many listeners are probably aware, are a certain typically text-based game spawning from a game called Rogue from actually 1980, where you are a little ASCII character. You descend a series of levels deeper into a dungeon in search of something around about level 26 or 32. There's different takes on it. The original was written by Glenn Wichman and Michael Toy. And immediately there are all these different variants of it. Hack, NetHack, Moria.
Hack and NetHack.
The first time I encountered it was actually technically the proper Rogue, as marketed at that point by Epix in 1986 for the Atari ST. It was a graphical version rather than ASCII. I know the Amiga version was like text characters, but graphics, little text graphics characters. There have been all kind of versions, Angband, and they've inspired a lot of. A lot of modern, modern games have roguelike elements. But anyway, it's an article that takes you from the beginning of Rogue, Rogue, and actually some of the predecessors. Interestingly, they mentioned one of the earliest was something called Beneath Apple Manor, which was an Apple II game that preceded Rogue, and it brought a lot of the elements together apparently that that made up Rogue before Rogue actually did. I think Rogue was much more expansive. But at any rate, it takes you through the history. I've always liked Rogue because you can play it on any platform, whether or not it has graphics. And it's a fun game. It's not too long, and it's engaging. It's a nice walkthrough with illustrations and I think, some video and different anecdotes. I put it in the notes, there is the modern version, which I'm most fond of, is called Brogue, and it's actually, it's I think it's rendered in graphics, but it has that old ASCII, ASCII aesthetic with, enhanced creatures, but it looks like you're looking at a super graphical text terminal, but it has lots of effects. The sound effects are great, and it has a lot of additional depth, and it's cool. Available for Windows, Mac, Linux, desktop, and it's in the I believe it's still on in the App Store on the iOS. I used to play it on my iPad all the time, and it's cool. I haven't reloaded a lot of things on an iPad. I got about 9 months ago, so I need to, and this reminds me to reinstall it, but it's a good article. So if you have any interest in Rogue or games that took something away from it, then this is a good read. It's Ars Technica piece, and they always do good stuff.
It looks like fun to read, and this Brogue looks really nice. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, when you actually play it, looking at, you know, looking at it, takes all the charm and atmosphere of, you know, the old originals, but it really adds a lot of you know, kind of psychedelic glitz to it. It's a great deal of fun. One of the games I've gotten lost in for like an hour or two deeper than most of the games I've played, really. I highly recommend it.
Nice.
Yeah, and I just a sort of like a link to add there. Last year at Kansas Fest, I have what amounts to a fair amount of the like development notes for Beneath Apple Manor. And so
interesting.
The Kansas Fest presentation that I gave last year was about that, about how I was about to make the scans available and all these things. Also, I'm just about to finish editing the previous podcast. But
I didn't realize that. Interesting.
It is. People have talked about Beneath Apple Manor as being like Rogue before Rogue. But
and Wizardry is Rogue after Rogue, but just different view.
And I actually have not really played it very much. So I was I realized when I was trying to present things about it, like I don't know the game really. You know, I scanned the things, but so I'm hoping still to get sort of into that more. Mm-hmm. But okay, so now we can turn to the upcoming show roundup, which is full of a bunch of bold notes. So things we have mentioned before, the 29th annual Last Chicago Cocoa Fest is postponed until further notice. It is not.
Or maybe the last one was actually the last one. They've been warning you for years.
Hopefully not. But it was going to be on April 18th and it is no longer. VCF East is now in October instead of in a couple of days. VCF Southeast is July 12th through something. And that at this point, I think, has not been changed. So it's conceivable that, I mean, I don't know if it's conceivable it will still happen, but it has not been, nothing's been announced about it. Kansas Fest in July 21st, has registration delayed until the end of April 30th. So it's, balancing on the edge of things, I guess. VCF West, August 1st to 2nd, is the first one in our list that does not have a postponement or cancellation notice. So we will see. I know that a lot of the sort of probably business and academic world is shifting to trying to figure out how to do conferences like this online. So it's quite possible that we might see a little bit more by way of streamed presentations about one's virtual, you know.
Maybe. I think like that works for modern business things and stuff. Like trade shows are useless. But for something like VCF or Kansas Fest, like it's all about being there and immersed. Like I really worry that like how would something like VCF transition online and be like something worth attending?
Yeah, I think it would be. I mean, like certainly with respect to like Kansas Fest or something, I would think of this as not. It's not like Kansas Fest. It's just something to do when Kansas Fest would have been.
Not a replacement, but an alternative.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. That makes sense. But like long term, like Kansas Fest is Kansas Fest.
Yeah.
And it'll come back. It's delayed or whatever. Like it's not, things aren't permanent.
I don't know if this is actually true so much of the other, of these other sort of conference conventions, but Kansas Fest is like a release target for a lot of people too. So if they're doing some sort of modern project, they intend to sort of talk about it or show it at Kansas Fest. And so that's one type of thing that might still be good to have something at. But anyway, we'll see. We'll see what happens. But what a mess.
Well, fingers crossed everything settles down.
So with our crossed fingers, it is now time for a word from our sponsor.
Imagine this chicken is your hard drive, and the 80s metal band Dokken is a computer virus. Dokken does not like chicken and wants to destroy it. The chicken, not knowing Dokken's intentions, doesn't really have any feelings either way. Now you have a choice. Would you like to allow Dokken to have its way with your chicken, unleashing a wrath the likes of which the chicken has never seen? Or would you like to deny it?
Whoa. Take it easy, bro. This ain't over.
Protect your chicken from docking. Deny digital dangers with Norton Internet Security 2010.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
Zuntite, you okay?
No, I'm not okay. I have that virus that's going around.
Oh, yeah.
You better stay back. This one's a doozy.
That's okay. I'll be fine.
No, do not be a hero. Last year, there were 114,000 known viruses for PCs.
PCs? Not Macs. So, you just grab this
one. I think I got a crash.
Hey, if you feel like that'll help, good.
And we're back. So today's host's retro computing gift idea is actually Jack's retro computing gift idea. So
it's been a coup. Jack's the new host.
So perhaps Jack can tell us about this.
Yeah. So this is a topic I mentioned earlier, was the Making of Prince of Persia, which is a book that came out about 10 years ago, but there's a new hardcover version. It's the illustrated edition. So it's basically, it's still based on Jordan Mechner's notes from when he built the game, his journals, but this edition adds screenshots of what the game looked like, photos of journal pages, photos of other stuff that he was working on it, just like stuff that was in his journal that was not in the previous version. And there's like, it's not out yet. It's coming out April 28th, but you can see it on Amazon. You can click on the look inside and see some of the pages and stuff. It looks very nice. It looks like, compared to just being a story, it has like all these sort of pictures of what's going on. I think it looks pretty cool.
Has anyone read the earlier version?
I have not.
Yeah.
I have not.
I'm pretty sure that I bought it, you know, but...
I'm pretty sure that you bought it too.
The problem with the time is just there isn't enough of it.
So do you know if there's an ebook equivalent?
Yes. Yes, there is. Cool. But there will be. So, but I think none of them are out just yet. It's supposed to be released in a month, on April 28th.
It's not very expensive. And I bet it's quite interesting to read.
Right.
I've read a little bit of the Karateka one. There was another one, that preceded this one, about the sort of development of the preceding game.
But right.
So far on this episode, we've had both pronunciations of that game.
Have we?
Awesome. My vote is for yours.
Well, I just happened to have, I watched this video with Jordan Mechner, and he said Karateka.
Yeah. No, I know, because he's right. But we all know that.
Yeah, but you know, people also. I knew people in the 80s who would also pronounce karate. No, it's karate.
Yeah, we had, okay. When I was doing for Touch Arcade, I did a interviewed Mechner for the iOS version, and yeah, he said karateka. So, pointing out that there's no emphasis on any syllable, but I always said, and I still say karateka. So,
yeah.
Well, I think we sort of grew up with that, but
soft G.
Okay, let's see. So now we can move on to our eBay auctions, if you still have money left over after the book that you bought, so, or pre-ordered, I suppose. Blake, you have the first set.
Okay, so interestingly, I've got just a few items here. This one caught my eye just because I'd never seen it before anywhere, and I am actually, you know, I've tracked the Amiga for years. I have several in this room, and I remember the Commodore PC and what its mice look like, but it's the original Commodore big-eyed mouse, new, never used.
It's a big-eyed mouse.
As if it's a renowned thing. I've never encountered this big-eyed mouse, and I don't have any idea what it's about. I wondered if anyone had seen it, or it looks to me, the connector. What kind of connector is that? Is it a? It's not an Amiga connector, and it's not a. It may be some sort of proprietary PC. It's bigger than a PS2. I don't know. I just wondered if anybody. I know you collect.
But could that be an old Mac mouse connector?
But a Commodore mouse?
Didn't they kind of look like that?
Like an ADB type?
Yeah.
Thing?
Yeah, it looks that.
What's ADB?
But why would Commodore make it? Yeah, that's how, you know, I don't know why they would.
I don't know.
Some of the, before the PS2 became a standard, like back when the PC had a connector, frankly, the PC keyboard connector used to look like that. There were a couple of proprietary, like I think there was the quote bus mouse, and then there were some video cards that had weird circular mini DIN mouse connectors. I don't know.
Yeah, like ADB is what mini DIN 4.
Yeah, I don't know.
There must be at least three other mini DINs.
Sounds like no one else has seen this before.
Well, it's bizarre.
It's a weird looking mouse.
Although it says new, never used, but the condition is used.
Because why would one? Yeah.
What are you going to use it with?
Never used so well.
$79, $8.85 shipping to me in Northern Virginia. Yeah, it's a curious thing. If it was like $5, I'd buy it. It's just because it's odd looking.
Yeah, it's a little pricey for something that's odd. But I noticed under the item specifics, it says brand Microsoft.
Really?
Just adds the mystery.
It's the new, never used, used mouse from Microsoft, labeled Commodore with an ADB connector.
Well, Microsoft made BASIC for everybody. I guess they also made mice.
I think that's probably just a template error.
Probably so.
Are we sure that's not a PS2 connector?
It looks too big to me. It looks a little big to me, but I guess I'm not positive.
I'm not sure.
Also, there's no banana.
We don't have a banana for scale. Yeah, it could be. You're right, Earl. It could be PS2. It feels to me like it's too big, but I don't know. But then again, that would make the mouse pretty big, wouldn't it? Maybe it is PS2. Maybe it is PS2.
That's
maybe
true.
Maybe it's just a big mouse. Two big old buttons. Oh, maybe it's not a big-eyed mouse. It's a big-eyed mouse. And so it's just a big mouse with eyes.
But when you look, zoom in, it looks kind of like an ADB connector, but it can't possibly be an ADB connector.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a Commodore mouse by Microsoft that's designed to connect to a Mac.
That's probably the best guess. I'm going to go with that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with that.
But it's the simplest possible explanation.
But I'm not going to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's even still true, but like when you got an Apple II or whatever, they would give you a little sticker, and then people would put those stickers on their disc boxes, and then people later on, when they inherit this from their deceased relative, put this on eBay as an Apple disc box. And I wonder if that's what we're seeing here. Someone has a Commodore sticker that they put on a mouse.
No, I found it actually on Zimmers.net, one of the Commodore information sites, and it is a PS2 mouse.
Okay, you're right.
Okay.
Maybe, no, I know Commodore had like the PC-10, they had some PC clones, maybe they said, we want to make a really, a big statement with our mouse for this thing, we need to come out running, you know, so here it is.
Wow.
Yeah. From the gate with
they
this
lost
thing.
Big time on this.
Yeah, I don't know, it's an interesting mouse, but, all right, well, thanks for solving that, Earl. all right, well, I'll move on to the next thing. I just was hoping that some of the people that have spent more years with Macs than I have could point out basically how one would use this. At first glance, it looks like a SIM module, but on closer inspection, it has four large square sockets with square chips in them. And it says GG Labs 2 MB Mac SIM. Mac SE 32SI 2FX Flash ROM SIM 64-pin Apple ROM disk. So apparently, and the descriptive text indicates, it's a Flash ROM 2 MB SIM for the SE 32SI 2FX. It says this SIM can hold a Mac ROM plus a 1.5 MB bootable ROM disk. So does anyone know, is this basically you? It sounds like you flash a copy of the Mac's ROM and whatever else you want on it, and then stick it in. What did these Macs have their ROM on a SIM stick? Is that
some Macs did around that era? I don't know 100% that the SE30 did, but
I didn't
absolutely
think
they were.
Okay,
I didn't think so either. But they could use ROM disks, definitely. So maybe this instead just goes into RAM and then has a thing that overwrites part of the ROM or something.
It's not as though there were a ROM disk socket on the board, right? That wasn't a common thing, surely. Or was there a socket for that? I see the picture shows it next. Clearly, there's a bank of RAM SIM slots, and here's this one, this one slot alone. The only Mac I had from this era was like the LC, and I don't remember any ROM disk business with that. But
because the SE30 definitely, people, I remember there was ROM patches for it. The 2CI and the 2CX, I think, had ROM on boards.
Well,
And the SE30 has a 2CI or 2CX motherboard, isn't it? Like basically the same. I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't recall either.
Or no, the SI had, weirdly, the SI, which is like the worst Mac ever, has a SE30 board they're the same computer, basically. One is the all-time greats, and one is the all-time worst, and the worst replaced the great one. It's some weird thing like that. So I'm going to say a hard maybe.
I mean, it sounds like...
Those at home, scream into your...
Sounds like you can, I guess, boot basically a floppy size extra...
A boot.
Yeah. So it's $49. And there's four available.
Bill in the comments just was hypothesizing that it's an early solid state drive. But it is ROM. So and I think actually Mac Classic, or there's some 9-inch Mac that has a boot disk in it. You know, that like it can actually boot into Mac.
The Classic does.
6 or whatever.
Yeah, the Classic is one of the ones where you can just turn it on and it's got a bootable thing built in.
Yeah. So it might be that might be the kind of thing you would use this for, but I don't think if it's a solid state drive, it's one that you can't write to.
Yeah, maybe so. I had never seen anything like this for the Mac, so that's why I.
It's a PLA.
You can put it in Commodore 64, and
as far as I know,
it's yours. There's four available for $49, and it is free shipping to me anyway in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
So let's see. The last thing I have, what is it? This I just mentioned this, kind of a personal connection sort of thing. It's there's a game that everyone seems to love. Everyone's heard of it. It is Boulder Dash, and I think Boulder Dash is. I don't know where it originated. Actually, I don't know what platform it originated on. But what I didn't realize, I guess, this is a package. It says Vintage Super Boulder Dash, Atari 48K64K. It's an unopened floppy disk, and it's a EA release from Electronic Arts back when they were good. And it has the album, the LP style, the classic LP style.
Yeah, like to me, those are the classic EA releases.
Yeah, the albums are great. The albums are great.
I love those. Love those.
Yeah, Can a Computer Make You Cry, that whole ad campaign, that whole time frame. but anyway, so I didn't realize that EA put out Super Boulder Dash. Did they put out the original Boulder Dash? I'm not sure. But I guess somehow I never realized that Boulder Dash was a commercial game. Like I see this, it seems like it was everywhere and every platform. Like I've run across it and clones of it everywhere, but I didn't know it was actually like a stamped branded thing. And so this is, here's evidence with the box. And I guess I'm guessing most of you were aware that it was commercial and that there were boxes and that kind of thing. Is that right?
I think Boulder Dash wasn't EA.
The first one.
Super Boulder Dash wasn't. Boulder Dash was like, I'm going to guess Microfun.
It's quite
one
old,
of those weird
I think,
things.
Right?
Yeah.
Like early one.
I feel like the original was not.
Vague memory.
Yeah, but it was some smaller.
Okay. Yeah. And the thing is.
But I knew that it was an actual commercial game. I'm sure I never bought it, but like.
Oh, yeah. Moby Games says Microfun. Boulder Dash, Microfun.
That was
Don't
nice.
Care. Look at that.
Yeah, I was nice. Scanning the back to try to see, but the.
I don't. And the thing is, for me, I actually don't like the game. Like I've never liked like all the different platforms. Like there's a clone. I think someone just made one for like the Pico 8, and then there's modern Amiga clones. I just don't like. I don't like Boulder Dash personally. So I've always avoided them.
You don't like it, Boulder Dash? I say.
So I just there's my ignorance. I just was putting it up there to see if that surprised anybody.
Interesting.
Else. So
I remember playing the original Boulder Dash on the Atari 8-bits, and I liked it okay. I wasn't super pumped about it, but it was a game that I enjoyed somewhat. But I've never actually my enjoyment of it was never such that I have ever played one of the modern remakes or clones.
I wish I could remember the name. There's a Boulder Dash clone for the Amiga that came up in some podcast a few months ago, and I thought, well, no one's ever heard of this. The graphics were pretty lame, but apparently it's one of the most popular Amiga games ever released because it was this perfect version. Like it added, and I again would have been excited, but Boulder Dash. So maybe I should take a look at that. But anyway, but that's all I got. It's 40. If you're interested in this particular Atari 48K or 64K package, it's $40 unopened with, $2.80 shipping to me in Northern Virginia, and they apparently have 10 available. So he's sitting on a pile of. I'm guessing this guy's probably selling a number of other unopened items. But
right,
Cool.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know if I've played Super Boulder Dash, but I kind of liked it, the original one. I would play that.
I wasn't a huge fan.
I would occasionally, like, you know, even in the modern day when I was looking for something to play, I would pick up that.
But, well, it's everywhere. But
no accounting for taste, I suppose. Okay.
Okay, my turn. Yep. I'm going to switch us over to a game that I do think is great and totally amazing. My first choice is there's a copy of Serpentine for the Apple II. This is one of the great Apple II pick-up-and-play games. I totally adore this game. This was a game that apparently came packaged. I wouldn't have known that as a child. I had this game, but holy cow, I definitely never saw this package when I was young. But you get it for $75, still sealed. And you know, that's not an outrageous price, as the game is very collectible and it doesn't come up a lot as a sealed copy. So if you want to release the 80s air and turn your Serpentine package into being worth less than it is, it doesn't ship to Canada. I would buy it anyway because I'm all digital. But this is a great game. If you never played Serpentine for the Apple II, I highly recommend it. It's basically Snake, but it's a great version of Snake, like a truly, truly great version of Snake for the Apple II. So that is my first choice. Have you guys all played this before? Did you all know this game? Did anybody actually pay for it?
I never paid for it, but it was one of my favorites on the Apple II, definitely.
Yeah, I loved it.
I'm not sure I've even played it.
Oh, highly recommend.
I looked up a video just now, and I recognize like the look of it. I've seen video of it, but I don't think I've actually played it.
Mm. It's great. Okay. It is a truly spectacular Apple II game.
I think the timing, and when the different little sound effects trigger and the pace, there's something that's just perfect that makes it much, much better than your typical Snake clone. Like it just feels right.
Yeah, it's shockingly good for a Snake game. Anyway, love it, love it, love it. That's my first choice. Second choice, it is No Man's Sky for the Tanicoco, also called Rescue on Fractalus. I like this game a lot. I didn't actually know it was a Coco game, so this surprises me that it's for the Tanicoco. And it is No Man's Sky, but for vintage computers. So Coco 3, so before my – or after my Coco time. But also sealed. I like a sealed game. $45 seems reasonable for a sealed game to me. So you could buy this and play No Man's Sky for the Coco – for $45. Have any of you played Rescue on Fractalus other than Blake?
Oh, I've played it a lot.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that I'm right now wearing my Rescue on Fractalus
t-shirt. Wow, look at that.
Oh, my goodness.
Good Lord. That's
fantastic.
That's incredible.
That is amazing.
I should have made you large, but anyway.
Yeah. And in charge. This originally sold for $29.95. There's a sticker, still a sticker on it. So it's gone up in price. It was a good investment. This person sells it. Yeah.
Good ROI.
They're making, good ROI. They're making 50% of their money, so pretty good.
Yeah, I've not played. I've probably started Rescue on Fractalus on the Apple II. Bill in the chat said that he did.
On the Atari 8-bit, at least it was great. I mean, that was the original platform it came out on, and it was really, really good. And I've seen actually people have taken a machine where they have swapped out the 6502 for a 6581 6 or whatever it's called, and the one that runs way faster, and suddenly it can render all those mountains at a much higher frame rate. It's pretty cool.
So that's my second choice. Both are just good games in sealed copies, and I like a good sealed copy, and neither of them have the shrink wrap that seems to be destroying the box. So, and not unreasonable prices for both. My next choice, the next two I have, are a little more interesting. This is a lot of money. It's a lot of money. It's $2,000 for an Apple IIe. But this is one of those ones. Let's say we've got a listener who just has a ton of money and wants to get an Apple II and just give me a good one. This is a really good one. I don't think it's as worth $2,000, but it is a 2E with a duo disc and a color monitor 100, which is a great monitor. It's the one you're not supposed to push on because you're breaking because it's like motorized. Mm-hmm. But it is a fantastic and rare and expensive monitor. It's got the duo disc, which I totally adore. So this is like an iconic Apple IIe setup. It's a beautiful, clean, working system. It's lovely. But can you justify dropping $2,000 on an Apple IIe? I cannot. But we might have some listeners who got a ton of money and good taste. And here's where they meet. It'll take your money and appreciate your taste. So it's $2,000, but it is a classic, beautiful, clean, perfect setup. So if you're a collector and you got bank, this is a nice one. It's just hard to justify.
Well, I always call it out, but you see there's a make offer button, right? Mm-hmm.
Offer $3,000,
and you know that's an RGB monitor, and it has so it has to have an RGB card inside. So it's actually
And it does, and it's working, right? Exactly. So it's not that this is crazily overpriced, but it's still $2,000 for an Apple II. And that's it's a lot of money. Just saying, it's a lot of money, but it's beautiful. Like it's just it's
in very good shape.
It's a great shape. Like it's this is a, like a no compromise one, but you're certainly buying yourself a high end Tesla of Apple II. It's still an Apple II. And it, for $2,000 US.
I remember the public library in the town I grew up had one computer in the public area, and it was an Apple II with this monitor. And I remember I used to go, they wouldn't, you had to do 6 months of training or something before they'd let you touch it, but I'd sneak over and press the motorized tilt button because it was so sexy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they were worried somebody's going to come up and just push on it, like the normal Apple II monitor and bust it.
Right.
Because the normal green screen tilt monitor is also a great monitor. I had that as a kid. I love that monitor. Yeah. That is a crystal clear, amazing, perfect, if you just want a green monitor. But this is the RGB one. Like this is the monitor, and they go for a ton.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of money for $2,000.
The motorized thing is very cool. The thing is so heavy. This is a super heavy monitor, but it's so heavy that there's a button that you press that it'll just sort of oscillate the screen up and down.
Yep. They have to do that because it's just like, you can't lift this. Anyway, it's great. It's a great monitor. I love the Duo Disc. I think they have a reliability issue. Some people say that,
they do. You know,
but I had one as a kid and I love them. And I think they're a beautiful look. So I really like them. It's just, this to me is an iconic Apple II setup. And I loved it. It's just, and it's clean. It's beautiful, but it's $2,000. Like, oh my gosh. Yeah. So, and then my third choice is something really fun and really interesting and really retro. I've shared the display, and this is a Proxima Data Display Multimode 2. There's a name. Sony must help them name this thing. So these are great. This is an LCD screen that, what do you do with it? It's a see-through LCD screen. So imagine you've got a monitor that has no back, because the whole point is you lay this down on top of a projector. So if you've got an old-fashioned slide projector, but those
like an overhead.
Yeah.
An overhead projector, but you put this on the overhead projector and it projects up through it and then it shows on the screen. I love these things. These are great. I think it's terrific. So this is one of those in a box, all the cables, looks new, but it's telling you that it weighs 7.5 pounds. It's a heavy item and it's all still wrapped up. So I suspect it's a new one. It is $67. Like this seems like a good price for one of these things. It's only $25 shipping to me. So it seems, given the weight of this thing, the fact that you can ship it to Canada for $25, this seemed like a good deal. So if you want one of these things, it's not shown to be working, but I think it's new. I don't think this is going to come. You're going to get one of these much cheaper than $67 US. Mm. So I dig it. Oh, it says 4 parts are not working.
They probably just don't want to guarantee it.
Yeah. Right. Because, still all cables still sealed in plastic. It doesn't see the remote control. Anyway, it looks 720 by 480 resolution, works with an Apple IIgs and Macintoshes and stuff. Like, this would be really cool to use at Kansas Fest. Hook up an Apple IIgs to this thing and just like, there's a lot to like here for $67. Yeah. So that was my second choice. Plus that name, that catchy, rolls off the tongue name, Proxima Data Display Multimode 2. Like, data display is two words, but multimode is one word with a capital M in the middle of it. Just, oh, it's great. This was a company that knew what they were doing.
Excellent. Cool.
That's my choice. Paul should buy this. Use it at Kansas Fest whenever that happens.
Yeah, I think when I was thinking about these, it does seem like as soon as you connect it, you're going to remember about how much nicer things have gotten since.
Yep.
But I don't know if I have a color one. I think I have a monochrome one somewhere that I've not connected.
But still, if you want a bigger monitor, you could hook this one up and just put it on your desk in front of you, turned backwards, and put a flashlight behind it and just project it on the wall and get a big monitor for your Apple II.
Cool.
Come on. It's great. That's a terrific way to do computing. No downsides.
Yes.
So those are my choices.
Excellent.
Cool.
Earl.
Okay.
What do you have?
What's my eBay choice this time is a compiler. It's for the Apple IIgs. It's from the Orca series of languages, which, as I understand it, were really popular on the Apple II. There's a whole family of languages. This one compiles the classic Integer Basic.
Wait, Integer Basic, but for the 2GS?
Runs on the 2GS.
That seems
weird. It's really interesting. There's a lot of...
Oh, I guess you're using the 2GS to compile it, but to run it on earlier.
No, I think you run it on the 2GS also.
Because that was WASD's so, basic.
Yeah, there's some...
But does that even run on the 2GS? Do you have integer... I don't understand this. Why would you use integer basic on a GS?
Because you can compile it. So you compile it, makes it,
it'd be really fast and have no division.
Exactly. It's compiled to... to like machine code.
It looks like they explain the whole thing in this that paragraph there that's on the screen.
I can't read.
I can't read that. But.
Don't you make me read.
Well, they do explain it on this one page that they show on the eBay auction from the manual. And some interesting things about it. One is it isn't exactly a standalone product. You can't use it unless you've got some of the other Orca family of language products because it works in conjunction with them. One of the things that I thought was the most interesting is that they include the source code for the compiler, which you can use, I think, for a couple of reasons that they talk about. One would be that you could change it if you want to add some of your own commands or do some of your own things. And secondly, I think it'd be a great educational tool to learn how compilers work.
Oh, or if you've taken a programming degree, you remember having to do compilers. Right. It's
the worst thing.
It's going to trigger ball.
The compiler course in my computer degree was one of the hardest.
Yeah, totally. For me, it was
the worst one.
Did you
ever
use the Dragon book in your course, Carrington?
Yes.
Sethi Aho, and I can't remember the other author, but very popular book. Anyway. Yeah, compilers. So having the source code for a compiler would be fun. And this is $29, so I don't think it's an unreasonable price. I just thought it was an interesting pick. And it is fascinating that it's integer basic, but for the Apple II GS. So it's like as far opposite as you can get on the Apple II continuum of computers.
It's actually a pretty funny image on the cover, too, because it's got like a GS and a GS monitor, but it's strapped to like buggy wheels and a dude with like take your 2GS back in time with integer basic. Like, so they know what they're doing. Yeah. I like it. I did not know this existed. The Orca stuff I knew, but I did not know this. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's sort of a compiler suite. So there's Pascal and there's I think the C and some other things, but
and they're available online. You can purchase them or they're like there's a whole set. I think that's available as a thing. I think I won it at Kansas Fest. I got the Orca collection, like for winning a door thing or whatever. That was my choice. Yeah.
Cool.
Because you can only have so many ROM cards for the Apple II.
Right. Particularly if you're running emulator only.
Yeah, exactly. My needs are small.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know. Oh, yeah, people would still use integer basic even, well, I mean, it was increasingly difficult, I suppose, but integer basic, as you might imagine, doesn't do floating point math. So it's actually faster. So if you want a fast basic program, integer basic is actually a pretty good choice. Mm. It's just that it's not by default available on any of the newer machines. You have to kind of load it into language space. Mm. But newer machines. I say newer.
Those newfangled machines.
Okay. Let me get started on my little list here. The first one is ended. But I think it's an interesting thing. So I don't know if people knew about the existence of this, but it is a 2-drive, 3.5-inch floppy for the Apple. It was only a prototype. This was never made. But it's basically just 2 unidisks on top of each other.
That's fascinating.
It would have been kind of cool. Somehow, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what it is that kept it from leaving the prototype stage. Anyway, so there are only a few of these around. This particular one just sold for just a little over 2,000.
My goodness. Wow. Holy moly.
For that, you could have bought that whole Apple II with the fancy monitor.
That's right.
Which I would rather have. But if you already got that, you've got all the things, and this is just one more of the things.
Next $2,000. Collect all the things. This.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, one of those things that people sort of, know about in the collecting world. You know, there are a few of them, but.
I saw one of these, I think, at Kansas Fest once. Probably Tony or somebody brought the Lyron disc.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Tony has or had one at least. And Blake, so you put a little link in the show notes. Is that what is the?
Yeah, I just put a link in both sets of notes. Frog Design had the people who did a lot of a certain period of Apple's design work. They did a historical display at their Frog Design location a few years ago, like 5 years ago, and one of the items that they displayed was that drive, and it's pictured in the collection of shots that I got for that event.
And weirdly, of those shots, that collection of shots, it is the least beautiful, least interesting thing.
Yeah,
you look at these other photos, like, oh my gosh, that is some beautiful, beautiful stuff.
This is what we're showing is a gallery. Clicking through on the image that we were talking about, it's a gallery of all the images that I was able to get a hold of from that event. So I'm sure we can do a link to the gallery.
I still love a lot of early Mac industrial design, particularly from the Frog period. But even more than that, Frog prototypes just make my heart ache for the things I would
like. There's
that
to amazing have. Book called, it's just a white book called, I believe it's called Apple Design. Does anybody else have that book? I have it at my office, which means I'm not going to see it for several weeks, but I can't grab it off the shelf. But it's just full of like hundreds of pages of color photographs of prototypes. It's been out of print for a couple of decades, but Apple Design, if ever you see one, grab it. It's all white with a little faded, like a fuzzy Apple logo in the corner or something. But it's quite nice. And there's a lot of historical, like, text describing what was happening. So.
Anyway, so that you cannot buy this prototype because it is sold, but not to me.
And it was so much money, you probably wouldn't have anyway. So it's all good.
Okay, the next one is, so this is a kit thing. It is a Apple IIe dual 6522 GPIO PCB. And so basically what it is I think you have to supply your own 6522s here, and you put them in. They are some kind of like serial IO, I don't know what you call them, but they're sort of taking care of the serial IO for you. If you plug this into a slot, it gives you basically a general purpose IO pin row that you can then connect up with various things that interface with those in these sort of modern, Arduino worlds. So it's sort of a kit that you can get. So soldering is required. You must know how to do this. You have to provide your own 6522 chips. But if you're interested in trying to kind of like, connect in some way your modern microcontroller thing, or even maybe a Raspberry Pi, to this. This is like one piece, the Apple II piece that you need.
So you think it like memory maps in ROM space or something like that for your IO? What I feel like it would do, like, you read and write certain memory addresses up in the ROM space, and then you could read or write the contents of those IO pins.
Yeah, I am fairly sure that is going to be how it works. I didn't actually look into it, but there is a GitLab discussion of this, which probably will tell you how the programming works.
I got to say, the sentence, "it memory maps in ROM space," sounds like something out of like a Gibson novel. Like it's something Johnny Mnemonic would say or whatever. And it's supposed to be like, sounds real, but it's totally gibberish. It memory maps in ROM space, man.
Right. Yeah, well, somehow you would need to be able to read and write to those pins. But.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, you guys are Apple II guys. So when you put an expansion card in the Apple II, then do those slots map into the high memory space? I don't know how that works.
It's possible for cards to sort of take, I think they can sort of take control of certain areas of space. So that's how like RAM cards work. You turn them on and then they intercept basically all the requests to a certain area of RAM and deliver their own contents instead. Mm. And I think each card has some really small, like one page of memory available to it for like a firmware. So that's where like the basic boot code goes and stuff like that. Anyway, that was interesting. If you're interested in that kind of a project, this might be of interest. It's $18, so it's practically nothing. There are five available. This is kind of cool. A clear case Apple IIc. Clear cases are all the rage.
Clear cases are all the rage. I haven't seen a 2C. I've seen the 2E or the regular 2s clear, but I've yet to see a 2C.
Is this old school?
The keyboards all should be clear. I'm getting triggered by the keyboards that you can't see through, though.
Nice. Yeah. Oh, the keys themselves, yeah.
I want the keys. I want the actual key. I want everything to be see-through. In fact, I just sent me like Emperor's new 2C. It'll be empty, and that's what I'm looking for. I'm going to be able to just see my desk and have nothing there.
Yeah.
The Wonder Woman Apple II.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So is this old school clear case, or is this a new kind of clear case?
It is. It's a one-off.
It's retro brighting gone wrong. Yeah. You put too much retro bright, and you actually like make it clear.
In the sun way
turns
too
out. Long. You leave it on. It's like, oh no, I left it overnight. Yeah.
This is not a prototype. This was made later, as I understand it. So,
it's, ooh, do that side shot on the monitor again. That is so cool.
Yeah, it is. It is
that
really
memory
nice.
Maps to ROM space.
Listeners, you can't see this, but what we're looking at is the side of one of the smaller Apple II monitors, and you can see some of the metal shielding in here. You can see, oh, the back is even cooler.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I would really like having this, but so I think it's. I don't think this is a project. This isn't like the Kickstarters or whatever, where they're they're looking to make a bunch of these. I think this is basically just someone made one.
How much?
$1,800.
But there's a make
Excellent.
Offer.
Excellent.
There is a make offer.
You yeah. and your make offer.
25 smackaroos.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what is a smackaroo to dollar conversion at the moment?
Things dollar's pretty strong right now. I think you get at least
Yeah, not the Canadian dollar, man. Oil down, Canadian dollar down. Hmm. You U.S. people with your fancy dollars.
All right. What else do I have?
Yeah, Paul, what do you got?
Oh, this is just not a whole lot to say about this, but it is a Lisa 2 bezel. So
it's 10% of a Lisa.
Yeah, exactly. But it's kind of cool because it's in the box. So and the box has a little bit of water damage, and the label ripped off part of it, and it's kind of squished.
But imagine you were 3D printing a Lisa 2 for yourself, and you started at the back, and then you ran out right before it was finished. Yep. This would help you complete that project.
Right. That is so weird. That happened to me last week.
It's a niche target, but they're, you know.
Yeah.
This is part of the kit that you could apply to your Lisa to reduce its future value by $100,000.
Yeah, I think so. I believe that might be
Lisa 2. Yeah.
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 The thing that always kind of bothered me about the Lisa 2 is that I'm not sure it actually says Lisa on it anywhere. I mean, there's a sticker underneath maybe that says
not
Lisa,
on the front.
Like the Lisa 1 at least said Lisa on it.
Not on the front.
But I mean, I guess if you've cracked yours, if you've played around with these at all, they're actually kind of flimsy. I mean, it's not super sturdy, and they're old, brittle plastic now. So I could see where you might actually even want it just for the bezel if you've cracked yours, but still $500. So, all right. This one I thought was kind of iffy. It's a fully operational Apple I computer engineered to work in a classic homebrew case. And you look at the pictures, it's got a little, one of those little security monitors, and it's got kind of like a wooden case with an Apple II Plus keyboard, I guess, cassette and stuff. Looks pretty homebrew. There's a plastic window through which you can see an Apple I board. Yeah, it's a little Apple I thing on
it. Okay, so how do we know what kit this is or whatever? It's not a actual Apple I.
I don't know, actually. It doesn't actually even say. It just says, perfect copy of the original with cassette board. So it seems to me like it took a lot of reading of, I would say fine print, but this is actually huge print. Right. But nevertheless, it's kind of buried there that it is anything but an actual Apple I. Original sold for $80,000.
Well, to buy it now for $6,000. Actually, it's pretty funny that it's $666.
Yeah.
Like that's a fun little pun.
Yeah.
But I think just the buy it now, $6,600 is kind of a big giveaway.
Well, sure.
So
yeah.
Seems a little high, actually. I mean, because you can get those kits. I mean, you can put one together for well under $1,000. I think. Well under.
Maybe not.
Also
well
know
under.
It's not an original Apple.
Well under $2,000.
Or Apple IV.
Probably. There's a number of people who've made replica boards, Apple I boards. I have one of them that I think was Newton computers or something. And it was possible, at least at one point, to just sort of like buy a package of the parts from, I think it might be called Unicorn Electronics, something like that. They sort of like, they had a kit basically for everything but the board that you could put together. And of course, there was a time when I thought, oh, it'll be fun to just find the parts myself. And now I have most of the parts. And it probably costs a lot more.
I think a small handful of the parts got really hard to find. There was one of the one of the folks at the Seattle Retro Computing Society who had painstakingly, you know, he had one of the replica boards that was an exact replica, and he'd gone to the work to find all original components for it, and he said it was, it took him a long time and it was quite expensive.
Right.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, the, you know, it's kind of cool to get the original parts, but I mean, you know, to the extent that you can get newer ones, they might be less likely to just like spontaneously combust.
That's true,
right? But I mean, even some of these things don't exist in modern versions. I mean, like the only things, the only way you could get this is an old one. So I forget what I think I have. I think I have many of these parts. I don't have that heat sink. And some other stuff, but I haven't even, you know, I haven't even begun thinking about putting it together. So anyway, I thought this was just a mildly suspicious auction. Okay. And then the last one is just kind of a cool thing. It is an extend a slot. For some reason, all my things are like Apple II only today, but
what's extend a slot?
So has anyone seen one of these before?
I remember ads for them,
nope.
For these in the Switch boxes, but I remember, I don't know if it was this one, but I remember, you know, in the back of a magazine, Insider or something like that.
So does this let you have the card outside of the Apple II?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you plug it in. It's basically, it's just an extension cord, mm-hmm. You know, you plug it in to a slot on the Apple II, and then it creates for you a socket, you know, slot socket outside. So here it's, you know, it says it's perfect for, you know, essentially having all your, the cards you always need inside and the ones you don't always need outside. So you can sort of switch them in and out.
So here's the hilarious thing. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, why in the world would you want to do that? And then I realize if you combine that with your previous auction for that GPIO board, that would be a really good reason to have the board out of the Apple II so that you could connect it up with your Arduino and other stuff.
I think that back in the, like I remember, and you see them on eBay coming across now occasionally, and you'd see them very rarely in the back of magazines long ago, but there would be, you know, prototype Apple II breadboards. So, you know, if you were going to try to wire together some, you know, something you were working on, this would make it, I mean, you'd almost have to have something like this or build one yourself. So I'm guessing that was, you know, because the company that sold this in the ad you showed, like right next to it in the magazine, they also made this thing that I saw more frequently, which was called Switch a Slot. And that was basically the one end of this cable, but instead of coming out to a slot, it goes into a box that has four slots and you just switch it. And, you can picture the copper brush action happening as you rotate that thing, praying for contact. I can't even imagine. But
make sure to do it with the power on.
Yeah,
is what you're saying.
Yeah,
so you can tell if it worked.
Yeah, the sparks will it lights up when it works. But but yeah, very nifty.
Yeah, I don't think I'd heard of the thing. It's true. I've seen these Switch a Slots. Actually, quite rarely on eBay. Mm-hmm. I've seen maybe two on eBay in the whole time I've been looking.
But, I knew a guy that had one, and I knew he had a 2E without a cover because he put his switched the card so often that he bought one of these things, and I thought it was cool. Mm-hmm. This is way back, a long time ago. But I think I just saw so many ads for the Switch a Slot in the magazines, but not so much this Extend a Slot.
Mm. Yeah. And the other thing that's here, the paddle at Apple, which is a similar thing. It's basically like it externalizes the place that you plug in the joystick or, you know, game controllers. Those were everywhere. I mean, like, you know, half of the Apple IIs that you find on eBay have one. Mm-hmm. I think that is it for my eBay auctions. So, okay. So that's good. So I think we can now move on to the closing discussions portion of the show.
Cool.
Carrington, you have a screen to share. Should I share your screen?
I do indeed. If everybody's stuck at home and bored and doesn't know what to do, somebody recently uploaded to the Internet Archive, Make It with Punch Cards, book from 1971 on crafts you can do with punch cards. So things awesome. Like making a lampshade. Here you go. So you can do a pleated lampshade from IBM punch cards. So it's a whole big old book of various things you can do, crafts you can make out of punch cards, and I think it's delightful. That's so if you're stuck at home with nothing to do, but you do have internet access and a bunch of punch cards, here's days of entertainment and crafting. And I think somebody at the next Kansas Fest should host a crafting time. I can see Melissa Barron doing something like this. It's like having like 5,000 punch cards to say, let's make lamps. Let's make things from our punch cards. So you can make various things to hang and display all out of punch cards. And I love it. Absolutely delightful. 1971 book. It's a tissue roll cover with a little doll face out of punch cards. Great. 1971 book uploads to the Internet Archive, and it brings me all sorts of delight. And that's what I think you should do with your punch cards.
I love that.
This is so cool. How did you find this?
Somebody on Reddit was saying, hey, I just uploaded a book called Make It with Punch Cards. I'm like, what is Make It with Punch Cards? Yeah, it's just great. It's so 1970s. It's like right from the era of macrame, but it's punch cards. So I love it. But I particularly love the fact that there are lampshades you can make. The lampshade just brings me great joy. So Make It with Punch Cards, 1971 book. I love it. That's what you should do.
Yeah. And it has a sort of at least it seems like a flavor of mockery of like the past tech now obsolete, right?
Yeah. Mm. You know what? Yeah.
So absolutely. You could imagine something like this, like make it out of floppy disks.
Mm-hmm. Now. Right. Yep.
You can almost smell fondue boiling looking at this thing.
Actually,
I'll be right back.
Right behind me, my fondue is bubbling. So that's what I got to share. Make it with punch cards, I say.
Excellent. All right. Blake, any sort of closing thoughts?
I don't have any items to share. I just, it's been a while at home here. Looks like it's going to be quite a few more whiles up ahead. So I've been actually taking breaks. Like, it's been nice at lunch to have some of the older machines, again, get on the BBSs and IRC in between bouts of those little pesky bouts of work that happen here and there during the day. So, I've been enjoying the cabin fever, the necessary cabin fever therapy of some of the retro computers. So that's just doing this and that I often don't have, time or the co-location to do. So, yeah.
Nice.
Earl, how are things?
Well, sorry again about my audio. I'm recording in a different spot in the house today. We're shifting some things around because my daughter's home from university. Of course, everything's closing and, doing remote learning and that sort of thing. So, yeah, we're playing a little bit of musical chairs. I'm kind of transitioning from one job to another. And so it's a little dicey right now because my onboarding is going to be weird because everything's shut down. Mm-hmm. So not exactly sure whether that's going to get delayed or what's going to happen. But if it comes to work from home, mostly, 11 out of the last 13 years, I've been work from home anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's not any kind of a culture shift. That'll be straightforward once I can get set up for it. So just, staying here, keeping safe, keeping busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Jack.
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing. There's a new TV show called Devs, which is like
Oh, I've heard about that. Is that good?
It's pretty good. I've seen the first couple episodes. It's like a sci-fi thriller sort of thing about this tech company. Nick Offerman plays the founder of this company, and he is not funny. It's a not comedic role at all, which is unusual for him, but there's a scene where they go into his office and standing on one side of the office is very clearly a Commodore PET computer.
Oh, nice!
I love it already.
The implication that he's a retro enthusiast of some kind,
or he's just old.
Just old, yeah.
Right. I like to call myself a retro enthusiast, but let's face
old
it,
old and confused.
Exactly. So I'll take it.
Cool. Yeah, I've been I've been planning to watch it, but I haven't hasn't quite made it to the top of the list yet.
What network is it on?
Here in Sweden, it's on HBO Nordic, but that could be anything.
Okay, I'll tune into HBO Nordic. Yeah.
They pull in stuff here that isn't necessarily on HBO in the US. It could be from anywhere. So Unsure. It's something. It's on something. Mm-hmm. Right. It's on a TV channel.
On one of them, their TV channels.
Yeah, I've been sort of. Actually, I just finished. I just ran out. We've been kind of addicted to this. It's a game show, basically, sort of, called Richard Osman's House of Games. It's a British thing where they basically just ask, like, you know, puzzle questions of celebrities, and it's really hard to stop watching that.
Okay, good. I like a British panel show and game show, so I'll check that out.
Yeah, so Series 3, which I just finished, has 100 episodes.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. That seems daunting. Yeah.
But it's still...
Especially from the country that only gives us 6-episode series. Yeah. What's up with you, Richard?
I think it's daily. It's a daily show. So, mm-hmm. Anyway, but I would recommend that. As far as, like, the closing notes, so I work in academia. I teach in the university. And so that's been a pretty sudden shift. That's actually has something to do with why we're recording an episode without the previous one being on the feed yet. But so suddenly I'm an online, you know, teaching expert, just like everybody else. And so it's a total mess for anyone in college at the moment. I mean, I think it's across the country, probably across the world, you know, people are being sort of like kicked out to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Earl's house, I guess. Sure. And
among others.
So I don't know. I'm not sure actually how much retro stuff I'll wind up being able to do. It's I can get to my office. There's not meetings or anything there anymore. So I'm probably not likely to be in the context of my retro computing stuff very soon. But anyway, the thing I stuck one more thing in the closing discussions section. I'll quickly mention it. There was a post. I'll put it on the screen here.
Apocalyptic.
Yeah, that's just another retro computing thing that I didn't have a place to put. But it was a interesting little thread that was basically talking about somebody who went back to the EDASM, which is the first editor assembler. It's the one that the Apple, you know, sort of, distributed for the Apple II. And, you know, it's basically just a sort of simple assembler, you know, assembly to machine language. And the post is actually really quite interesting. It's long, and like all long things that I talk about in this episode, I haven't read it all. But it's really actually, it's very involved and really kind of interesting. And it's posted on the Retro Computing Forum. So it has not only the original post, but then quite a lot of, you know, discussions after it.
Nice.
And
that's a good place for this. Cool.
Yeah. And so, in fact, actually, the thing I wanted to, one of the things that made me want to bring that up is that there's a Retro Computing Forum.
Oh, had we not talked about that?
I don't know if we have. It is basically the successor to a Google Plus group. When they shut down Google Plus, this was started from that. So it's not super old. I mean, it was basically just a place where people landed, and I have not been keeping up with it. I get you know, periodic email summaries from them because I have some sort of feed set up.
Oh, I totally missed it. I thought this was the forum that we've talked about every episode forever.
No, this is a different one.
This is a whole new thing.
And so if you are stuck home, there's a ton of stuff to read here. Like I intend to do a lot of stuff. My future topics may well be drawn from things on this site.
Look at this. But, hey, Blake, I don't need your tweets anymore. Look at all this new stuff I can talk about on the show.
This is pretty nifty.
Take that, Blake.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I sort of feel like it's, apart from the people who are on it and contributing all the time, it's a little bit under the radar. But go check it out, cause it shouldn't be.
And has a bunch of activity. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Excellent. Nice. So, hey, you kind of side reminded me there, Paul, to also give a shout out to Kevin Savitz. First, though, for superstitious reasons that I can say his name on the episode. And secondly, because I dumped about 2 metric book tons of Vax VMS manuals on him, which he so kindly offered to scan. So just, you know, a public shout out in gratitude for that. I talked about it on an earlier episode. I saw you tweeted about that, Paul. As it turned out, due to my job transition, I no longer had access to a document feed scanner. So I was thinking, wow, what am I going to do with these? I mean, they're holding down my house, but what else am I going to do with them? So Kevin said, yeah, I'll do it. So I was like, you demand. So I took it all over. Awesome. And, yep. It's in better hands now.
And better decorated nails.
Exactly. Exactly.
He does rock the good nails.
Yeah, in fact, I when I was looking through eBay auctions, I did briefly look to see if there was any large collection of deck manuals that I could suggest to you, Earl.
So that I could replenish my collection? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that, Paul.
All right. It looks like we've been recording for a million years again, but it's been fun. We're all trapped at home. But I think I will close this off here and say that's it for this show. You can find show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php, or maybe on the retrocomputing forum, although we don't have any actual presence there. But I think we will maybe all soon look there. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro-Compute!